Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show, making a noise, throwing some shapes and running like a rabbit through the big movie releases. There will be solos and possibly encores. We're playing all week at a screen right near you. Coming up in the next 20 minutes, the great animator Hayao Miyazaki takes flight for what may prove his career swan song with The Wind Rises. Lindsay Lohan points the way to an orgy of the damned in Paul Schrader's notorious The Canyons. Plus, we meet the worst football team in the world on the sports documentary Next Goal Wins. First on the set list, it's Frank, a tale of a dysfunctional band, a masked frontman, and the plucky new recruit with his eyes on the prize. The Guardian's Henry Barnes sat down with director Lenny Abramson, writer John Ronson, and the film star Drommel Gleeson.
Frank wants us to start everything from scratch.
No color coding.
He's created an entirely new musical notation system. We've designed our own instruments. He has initiated the strict regime of physical exercise. Fortunately, we have a safe word for when things get too intense. Chinchilla.
Sometimes I feel that what we're saying, even though we don't realise we're saying it, is look at us, we're normal, this is the average. You know, we're like defining the boundaries of normality by ridiculing or mocking people on the outside of normality.
The head. Take it off.
I have a certificate.
So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this film, is because I wanted to just sort of write a film that just kind of celebrates marginal life, you know, that's not in any way mocking or ridiculing or attacking. It's just a celebration of life on the margins.
Why do you wear that?
You think it's weird?
Kinda.
Well, normal faces are weird too, you know? The way they're smooth, and then, you know.
When people sort of ask us about the relationship between our Frank film and Frank Sidebottom and Chris Seavey, I think what we've said or what we feel is the truest description is to say that there's like a spirit in common, that there is that it's true to Chris's kind of intense, like maverick, playful, but ultimately really quite serious approach to what he did. Actually, I think the way to think about Frank is like, well, if Frank Sidebottom fell asleep and had a dream, then maybe this film is his dream.
I dedicate myself to learning his secret, and I will not let anybody get in my way, however desperately they may try.
Somebody's thinking of the key of C!
It's me!
He's also got this idea of almost a natural talent, and he's very comfortable in being who he is, whereas your character is very much about forcing the idea of excellence upon himself. Which one of those do you feel more kind of akin to, I guess?
Are you asking me if I think I'm talented or not talented?
Okay.
Is that what the question is? Well, there's no right answer, is there? No, I would like to think I'm more talented than John, who has literally zero talent. And let me be clear, I'm talking about John Ronson here. I'm talking about John in the movie. He has no talent to back up his huge ambition. Frank has massive talent, and his only ambition is to make himself happy by expressing himself. It's like, I think Michael says, it's like, you know, it's like breathing for him, writing music. He couldn't not do it. So, I mean, you would like to imagine you're closer to the Frank end of things. But then I guess you follow John for the movie, so maybe you're meant to, I don't know which way you're meant to fall, I don't know.
Joining me now is the Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw, while beneath the fetching fiberglass head, and you have to trust me on this, is none other than Andrew Pulver. Peter, this is a sort of deliberately confounding film, isn't it?
Yes, I found it very confounding. The whole thing was very unusual. I couldn't really think of anything to compare it to, weirdly. I thought there was something kind of brilliant about it. I find it very beguiling and very absorbing. And there was something, a kind of stroke of genius in a way, in casting Michael Fassbender, this very, very famous bloke, and then not letting you see his face for most of the film. in and of itself, it's quite a clever comment on celebrity.
Absolutely. It's totally of a piece with what the film's trying to say.
Yes, absolutely right. I found the whole thing, the revelation at the end, I thought, how are they going to play this? Because, you know, Fassbinder can't stay off stage forever. And yet when they do do it, interestingly, not showing you his face full on for a while. And then when it resolves somehow it kind of comes together. Mm. And it's very touching in a very bizarre way. It kind of sneaks up behind you, this film. Mm. It really does.
Andrew, what did you think of it?
I've got to say, it sort of grew on me. I found it a bit difficult to sort of get my head around it at first. Partly because I just couldn't understand why they hadn't made a straight film about Frank Sidebottom. I mean, it seemed to be overthought that they had this film about this guy in a big plastic head who was a musician, and they'd sort of fiddle about with it and set it in the modern day and made him not Mancunian and, you know, all this sort of stuff.
There's a lot of Twitter action.
Yeah, a lot of Twitter action, which you know, is the sign of a very irritating sort of film happening. Trying very hard to capture the audience, throw out a few hashtags themselves, you know, that sort of stuff. But I think it's partly because just the relentless focus on this guy in the head worked. There's something weirdly expressive about the face, even though obviously it doesn't change. At certain points in the drama, when they're sort of screaming at each other or the Frank character's very upset, it's sort of the face does seem to look sad or happier, and it does take on these very weirdly expressive qualities. So in the end, I think for me, it did work, even though I did find it a bit of a struggle at first.
What is it saying? It kind of wrong-foots us, doesn't it? Because basically it's saying outsider art is good and we all like the avant-garde, but then actually if you drag it into the limelight, it there's a kind of contradiction there.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it's saying about the difference between insider art and outsider art. Perhaps it's saying that the difference between insider art and outsider art is purely a matter of scale. It's interesting, this use of Twitter, the idea of followers, like a sect leader or a cult leader suddenly gaining more and more followers. And Frank as a kind of, I would say, sort of Jerry Healy figure, or perhaps even a kind of benign Charlie Manson. He exists to draw everybody into himself. Mm. And he has nothing to offer them other than his own insecurities, which he feeds back to them and they feed it back to him. Mm. And I like the idea that John, this sort of John Ronson figure, could somehow tempt him, like a sort of Mephistopheles, tempt him into commercially selling out with
his almost
likability.
Like a villain of the, in a kind of indirect way, the plucky newcomer becomes actually the worst thing
sort
that can happen.
Facile and superficial and inauthentic, somebody tempting Frank away from the true path of failure towards the facile and contemptible world of success.
Don't get me started on lips. Like the edges of a very serious wound.
That's true. But your head is still sort of intimidating.
Well, underneath, I'm giving you a welcoming smile. Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud?
Well, maybe.
Welcoming smile.
Delighted look.
That's Michael Fassbender, possibly in the rather fine Frank. Next up, the hapless 11 of American Samoa are still looking for their first win in the football documentary Next Goal Wins. Will these guys never get a break?
You can't change anything on the internet. It's still going to stay in the record for a long time. It's embarrassing, you know?
I was there when Australia beat us 30-0. 30 or 31, I'm not, but I know it was 30.
Meet the national team of American Samoa, its players wiped out to Australia and sit at the bottom of the FIFA world rankings. Still, they've got pluck in abundance and are crying out for a stroke of luck. Directors Mike Brett and Steve Jameson spin sporting disaster into a feel-good triumph.
Damiz is a real professional high-level coach.
Go! Pressure! Vitala! Go, buddy!
He's tougher.
You're playing yourself out of the starting 11 right now. If you're not going to be mentally tuned in, you're a risk, man.
When he get here, Thomas was a very difficult person to deal with.
You brought me here to put a winning team on the field. Then don't interfere.
I told him, if you don't like it, you just pack your things and go back home.
I got a man that's really discovered she has more female tendencies. The goalkeeper is the only guy that wasn't at 31 to nothing loss. They're scars with this team.
Andrew, what was it that initially drew you to this tale of lovable underdogs with more heart than skill?
Well, you really put your finger on it there. It's very easy to be dubious about sports documentaries these days because filmmakers have to sort of basically make a deal with corporations that own people. I've seen tons of them where you just are always aware of this sort of carapace. But with this, they've sniffed out a fantastic story, and luckily for them, it all happened in front of their cameras. I mean, you can imagine them going all the way to American Samoa and then sort of sitting around for a year and not getting the shots that they needed, which was this team, this very hapless team who were bottom of FIFA rankings for years, finally getting a win, which they beat Tonga in 2-1 in some World Cup qualification tournament. But
having lost 31-0 to Australia back in 2001.
The sort of legendary all-time biggest international defeat. I think the great thing about this is you don't need to be interested in football at all.
I was
going to
say, because I don't like football, so what's in it for me?
I'd say it's a beautiful story about the little guy triumphing over the odds. I mean, as I said, you don't need to know anything about football. Apart from all the football stuff, which is sort of a fascinating marginalia in the world game, you have a terrific insight into a sort of very small Samoan island and how they operate. I mean, there are some fantastic characters in this, particularly, I think the one really standout one is one of the team is the first transgender footballer. Mm. Then they eventually get hold of this guy who is a Dutch ex-footballer and manager who's had some experience at pretty high level. Wants to come. He has his own story. He's, you know, lost a family member and trying to somehow redeem his own bitterness in his own life. Mm. And he comes to Samoa and instills a certain amount of professional behaviour in them. And it works. They gradually get better. And one of the great things he does is he puts the transgender player, who didn't really think she had much in her as a player, and he says, you know, she's the only one that really gets stuck in. Mm. These fantastic scenes of her putting in these kind of really heavy tackles when, you know, these other sort of bigger, more macho blokes are sort of lumbering about the pitch, not really paying attention. And she's almost the key to making the team work, really.
And is it a celebration then of just playing for the sheer hell of it?
Absolutely, but there's more to it than that. Mm. It's an insight into a culture where they're not so interested in making money, beating people. They enjoy it, and it's sort of part of a very religious community, and the playing football and winning is a sort of religious and spiritual celebration for them.
Great players, they want to be on the highest stage, and this is the highest stage. This is where you should go, wow. I would cut off my penis to play in a World Cup qualifying game. I've never played in one. I've dreamt about it when I was 2 years old, when I started playing the ball in the streets in Amsterdam, because that's all we did was play soccer. International football, it's the best.
American Samoa playing their version of the beautiful game in Next Goal Wins. We now leave the pitch behind to zip into the clouds with The Wind Rises, which comes billed as the last feature from the Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, and it may just be his most personal one of all.
Which world will you choose?
I just want to create beautiful airplanes.
Like that?
Miyazaki's ravishing fact-based animation tells a story of pure artistry and its impure results. Jiro Horikoshi is the wide-eyed genius who designs beautiful planes, a romantic dreamer who loves a beautiful girl. Miyazaki clearly reveres Horikoshi, and his film suggests that we do the same.
Bravo! A beautiful dream.
Peter, if this is Miyazaki's last film, is he going out on a high?
Yes, I think so. I don't think it's an absolute masterpiece, but I do think it's a very, very good film indeed. I thought it was beautiful to look at. I was very touched by its what I found to be its innocence and its idealism. I'm still not sure whether I've correctly interpreted it in a way. I found that the elephant in the living room about this film is the war.
Yes.
It's about Jori Horikoshi. I think I understand it. Jori Horikoshi is an aeronautical engineer and pioneer who is famous for having developed what are effectively fighter planes in World War II. Now, Hayazaki insists on concentrating on the kind of innocent prelapsarian world of his early life as a young dreamer, an idealist, a visionary, who was motivated by aircraft as civilian, as the civilian aircraft, something which has nothing to do with killing people. And this was what it's all about. And the fact that it's sort of short of the Second World War is what is there to give it a kind of ironic poignancy. And I get that. I think I get that. Although there are scenes, very important scenes, where he supervises pilots practicing power dives. Now, that can only be a reference to the Divine Wind, Kamikaze.
Yeah. And he says, what are these planes going to be used for?
What are they going to be used for? Well, of course, we know what they were going to be used for.
And maybe he should have done too.
And maybe he should have done too. But there is, it can't be an accident. Miyazaki can't have put that in by accident and just be blunderingly unaware of the entire history of World War II. He must, at some kind of tacit or subtextual level, be talking about a world in which aircraft are used for suicide bombing or indeed carrying atom bombs.
I thought it was beautiful. It's innocence and its idealism is what actually drove me nuts about it.
Yeah,
that kind of incurious nature of the main character that seemed to be matched by Miyazaki's incurious nature about the main character.
Yes.
I thought that there's a great film to be made about art and its consequences and where the responsibility of a great artist ends. Wasn't it. He lets him off the hook.
I think he does let him off the hook, or at least he gestures at the existence of the hook and says that it is not his purpose to put him on the hook.
Irrelevant.
I'm not sure that it's irrelevant. It's just not what's coming into his frame. He wants to talk to, I think, possibly a Japanese audience who are only too well aware of it. In a way, I think possibly we are sort of approaching it as a Westerner, as not a Japanese audience. I get that, though. I understand where you're coming from about it. And that's why I don't think it's a kind of great masterpiece. But I think it is that rarest of things, a genuinely beautiful film. So often when we say films are beautiful, it's sort of a euphemism for a bit boring. I don't think it is boring at all.
No,
I found
it
utterly absorbing, and it genuinely is it is a beautiful film.
That's Miyazaki's undeniably beguiling, arguably exasperating The Wind Rises. Now, where better place to end than the ruins of Hollywood? In Paul Schrader's The Canyons, the players are jaded, the picture palaces are rotting, and cinema ends with both a whimper and a bang.
So you met Tara?
Yeah.
She's hot, right?
It's more fun to keep it a little complicated.
And you don't get jealous?
Is this guy for real?
No, I do not get jealous.
Rattled by backstage tensions, burnt by bad reviews, The Canyon is a dead-eyed satire about Beverly Hills zombies, a jaded film about jaded people. And here's Lindsay Lohan, hoop earrings a-twitching, as the trophy girlfriend of an immoral producer, enshrined in her soulless pleasure dome and preparing for an orgy.
I found myself in the emergency room.
On drugs, and she's obsessed with me.
Andrew, I remember we saw this at last year's Venice Film Festival, where it was quite the talking point.
It certainly was. I mean, we have to say this is still one of the most extraordinary films that we've ever really had to kind of try and think about. It is obviously we all know script by Bret Easton Ellis, directed by Paul Schrader of American Gigolo, renowned but hasn't made a good film for years and years. Lindsay Lohan's in it.
You're going to leave it at that.
This James Dean guy is in it.
James Dean with a career in adult movies. Yeah. I remember looking at his credits, merely his credits, I hasten to add, which include things like Babysit My Ass, Dude, Where's My Mom, and My First Orgy 2. That was my favourite. My First Orgy 2.
He was good in that. For me, it is such a curate's egg of a film. There are some things about it that are genuinely fantastic. There are some heavyweight ideas rolling around here. Obviously, Bret Easton Ellis is no idiot. And Schrader has come up with some great stuff, some great scenes. But it's also fatally compromised for me by some awful acting, particularly some terribly written scenes that just sort of shriek student, sixth form type level stuff. It's just very, very dull, serious stuff. I don't know, there's some great bits, some terrible bits. In the end, you know what Bret Easton Ellis is trying to do. doesn't always happen, but sometimes it does in the, within the same. And I can feel Peter twitching.
You're going to ride to the defence.
I am going to ride to the defence. I know what Andrew means. I think it's had a very bad rap. I think there's lots of interesting stuff in this film. Paul Schrader is not a fool. Bret Easton Ellis is not a fool. It's very flawed. But it's so atmospheric and creepy and mad. In some ways, it's a lot more interesting than some of the kind of more respectable and more polished films that we see all the time. I mean, not a week goes by in this business before without us swooning over some neglected masterpiece from the 70s that used to be derided by the critics. Something like, say, for example, Peeping Tom, which was mocked and sneered for being rubbish and offensive by a director who's past his best, all the things. And you can't watch this film without thinking, wait, are we having our Peeping Tom moment? Are we all going to beat up this film, which a lot of smart asses in 30 years' time are going to say, this is a masterpiece. All those middlebrow idiots who queued up to beat up poor old Paul Schrader, and he actually made this kind of crude, brilliant, flawed, interesting film, all these idiots back in 2014, 2013, preferred all these sleek and uninteresting movies that we've all forgotten about. And I have to say, maybe that's going to happen to the Canyons. I personally think there's lots of stuff about the ruin porn pictures of cinema, and that it's the end of cinema. I actually looked at it a different way. I think what he's saying is that's the ruin that was there all the time. All the time there was this corruption underneath cinema. Yeah. Cinema enables a vast wash of soft money and soft power underneath the end product. There's lots of bullshit artists and creepos and weirdos manipulating and playing power games. That's what's been happening with cinema ever since 1920. That's what's happening now. I mean, nobody's interested in this film he's allegedly going to make. Nobody even mentions the title of it. Another type of author would have shown us a clip of this film.
It doesn't matter, though, does it?
But it doesn't matter.
None of it matters.
None of it matters, and that's interesting. I found it very interesting. When I saw those ruined porn pictures, I actually thought of the creepy, knackered old porn cinema that Travis Bickle goes to in Taxi Driver. I think it's very interesting what Schrader and Bret Easton Ellis are saying. I don't think they're saying necessarily it's the end of cinema, although that's part of it. I think they're saying that there's a ruination and a kind of exhaustion that was there all along.
Yeah, it's always been a necropolis.
Yeah, it's always been like that, yeah.
Okay, tell me something. Do you really like movies? Really, really like movies? When's the last time you went to see a movie in a theater? You know, a movie that you really thought meant something to you. I don't know, you know, I guess maybe it's just not my thing anymore.
Lindsay Lohan reeling towards the credits in The Canyons. Happily, it turns out that cinema is not quite dead yet. Next week, the Guardian Film Show decamps to the Cannes Film Festival, where we'll be posting daily videos from the heart of the Croisette. So, a tutelur, we'll see you next week.